Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, listeners, I want to thank our good friends at Slipped Disc for their enthusiastic support of Speaking Soundly. Be sure to check out slippeddisc.com for the latest inside information on classical music now. Today's episode featuring Lara Downes continues our celebration of Women's History Month by featuring female artists who are breaking barriers and changing the music world. American classical pianist and trailblazing cultural activist Lara Downes captivates audiences with brilliant performances while highlighting the voices of underrepresented female and Black American composers. A musical mission born out of necessity and fueled by personal experience.
There was always this sort of missing piece where I was in love with the music, and I'm born a very curious person, so I always wanted to know the stories behind the music, and there was no place in those stories that reflected me.
You're listening to Speaking Soundly, a backstage pass to today's biggest stars of the music world. I'm your host, David Krause, principal trumpet of the Metropolitan Opera. During each episode, you'll hear me speak with inspiring performers about their creative process and the personal journey that led them to the stage. It's great to see you again after bumping into you a few weeks ago outside of David Geffen Hall in Lincoln Center. Were you coming out from rehearsing that marathon long concert of all Philip Glass piano etudes? It was like, what, 3 hours long, something like that?
I was either on my way to or from rehearsal. And yes, it was a marathon, but it was a great marathon. It was so much fun.
I love listening to Philip Glass's music. It's hypnotic, but performing it is a completely different thing altogether, right? I mean, it's like the repetitive motions, the concentration it takes just to keep track of where you are in the music can be mentally and physically exhausting.
It's the most exhausting.
Right? So when you step off the stage and walk out onto 65th Street, is your head still spinning as you re-enter daily life and have to like shop at Trader Joe's or whatever?
It's so interesting that you say that. And this, you know, these concerts were really unusual in that there were 10 of us playing the 20 etudes, which was fascinating on so many levels, because as you say, yes, Glass is hypnotic and, you know, there's this, obviously there's the repetitive motion and everything. But when you break that down into 10 very different players, it took on a whole new life. And all of us were talking to each other backstage about deep dive that you need to do and just the incredible, like, focus and energy on every level that this music demands. One of the things I realized in these last weeks working on that music is, you know, the world is awful, right? And so this music was providing this like cocoon where not only could I, but I had to go inside of it and just be there. And it was a really, really interesting experience.
Well, Philip Glass is a well-known contemporary composer whose works you play beautifully. But your musical mission has been to discover, amplify, and perform composers who have been historically overlooked
because of either racial or gender discrimination. It would certainly be easier to have a career performing from the wealth of popular repertoire out there, but instead you decided to embark on this mission. How did that become central to your musical identity and your musical career? Like, why take on that challenge?
Because of what you just said, because of musical identity, you know? I don't know how old you were when you started your instrument. I was 4. So it's a lifetime. And I think that we buy in, you know, we are like all in, we're committed from the beginning. And that's sort of the message, like to do this, you devote your entire self. And of course you fall in love. Otherwise, it's not going to happen, right? So deeply, deeply falling in love with something when you're 4, 5, 6 years old and finding your place in it. And for me, there was always this sort of missing piece where no question, I was in love with the music. And I'm sort of I'm born a very curious person. So I always wanted to know the stories behind the music. And there was no place in those stories that reflected me, you know, either as a girl, as I was then, or a person of color, even not so much, honestly, as an American artist. So I just dealt with that for the longest time. And I'm realizing now, you know, so many of us do have this identity crisis of one sort or another at some point in the training, you know, when you're, maybe it has to do with your adolescence, I don't know, but there's a place where you kind of have to reckon with yourself. And my place of reckoning with myself had to do with the otherness that I had always felt that I took for granted that was fine, except then it wasn't fine anymore.
When did that happen? When did it become not fine?
I think it was at some point, you know, I did my advanced studies. So from my teens through my early 20s in Europe, which was even more of this, you know, connecting with the European tradition, like in a really intimate way. And then when I came back to the States, I think is when everything kind of fell apart internally, because that curious part of me that wants to know things and understand things, I think had also been feeling frustrated for a while with the part of tradition that has to do with like just kind of following blindly, do you know? The answers to my questions tended to be, well, because that's how we do it, you know, because that's how we've always done it. That didn't mean too much to me. So I think I did struggle. I mean, I struggled in so many ways, right? Coming back to this country, not having been here for a long time, meant sort of finding my footing on all fronts.
So it was when you came back to the States with that perspective and it immediately dawned on you that there's a disconnect there.
It was on all levels. You know, here I'm coming back. And now I'm a grown up, right? I'm not a little kid anymore. I'm by myself. When I had left, we had all left together as a family. So there was a lot of figuring out to do. But a big part of that, and also, you know, starting from zero and just like hustling to make music, to find a place to make music, really, it was clear to me that I had to understand myself. I had to understand why I was doing this. And I think I just ran up against, early life crisis of some sort. But as soon as I started figuring out my way, learning more about American music, I immediately started to feel grounded and connected to something. And there was this one moment, there was this exhibit at the Guggenheim called The American Century. And it was a retrospective of American art throughout the 20th century. But it was beautifully curated so that all of the artworks were situated in sort of umbrellas that had to do with context, social movements, music, what was happening, you know, what people were experiencing. And that was what I had needed to understand. How does this all fit together? And then, I don't know, things just started to make sense. And then I had a job to do.
And you've been doing that job. What's the process like for you as you discover the music of these underrepresented composers? I mean, I'd imagine that every scrap of paper that Beethoven, Bach, or Tchaikovsky scribbled on is on a museum under glass somewhere. But is there that same kind of curated catalog of the underrepresented composers who you champion?
There is not. You probably know the story of Florence Price's music and where it ended up. She died in 1953. And in 2009, so half a century later, this young couple bought this falling down house in rural Illinois, like an hour south of Chicago. I mean, really just dilapidated house. And in the attic, they find these boxes and boxes of manuscripts. Open to the elements. No more roof on this house. Rodents and weather and, you know, just all man. And they had the presence of mind to look at the signature and do some digging. And they took those boxes down to the University of Arkansas, to the archives. But had they not cared, had the house not been bought, I mean, so many ifs, right? Those boxes could have ended up in a dumpster or just destroyed beyond recognition. And this is a story over and over and over again. And I think this is, to me, why this mission has become so huge, because no, there hasn't been the care. There's often just nobody to, you know, steward these legacies. There wasn't the support from the beginning, right? All of these manuscripts of Florence Price's, these are still found in handwritten form because she didn't have access to copyists or, you know, much support in the publishing world. So, you know, I always think about that story of Pablo Casals finding the Bach suites in a secondhand store. But there are so many stories of great works of music being lost and recovered. But this is different because this touches so many big questions about history and access and privilege, inclusion.
When you perform these works that you curate, my guess is that most people in the audience have never heard them. Like, I've been listening to your albums, and I'm a musician, and I haven't heard most of the works, except for, you know, you do one Billy Joel tune that I know very well. Does that fact make it more challenging to perform, or do you find that audiences, by and large, are begging for something new?
I think there's so much joy in receiving this music. It's very energizing. And also, that's how the canon grows. The thing that I have to push back against, honestly, is misguided marketing, especially around this particular body of work that I'm trying to share. I think as an audience member, if you come into a hall and what you've been told is you're now going to hear this work that has sadly been neglected because racism, blah, 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 then you're kind of like in a mood. So I'm always trying to get in front of that. Like, no, this
is a good
is
way
not,
to put it.
Right? Like, just, you know, so I think what I'm sharing is my joy in the discovery, and it is very personal. And I feel very, very fortunate to be the fingers and the face of this music. I think one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had. I was playing the Florence Price Concerto with Detroit. This is a couple seasons ago. It was when we were just coming back from pandemic stuff. So they were doing the first school concerts that they had done since the pandemic. And so, you know, the hall was full. Kids bust in, mostly black and brown kids. And I played the concerto and I was speaking in between the different sections of the concerto and trying to give them the story and the context. And at the end, before the third movement, it's a juba dance. And so I said to the kids, you know, this is Florence Price reaching back to her ancestors from Africa who had to develop this dance in slavery because they weren't allowed to have drums. So you're making a drum of your body. And here she is in, you know, the 20th century trying to have access to this place, this beautiful, fancy hall that you're sitting in. And like, no one's inviting her. They're saying no, thank you, pretty much. And she had a choice. She could have just written a beautiful standard European sounding symphony. She was a very good composer. That was easy to do. Or she could say, no, excuse me, I'm bringing my ancestors with me because we all belong here. So I said that to the kids and I said, you know, we all in fact belong here. And, you know, they were so excited and there was this great moment. And then I went back to the dressing room and I just like, it hit me what that meant. All these kids, hundreds of kids, their first time in a symphony hall. And this is what they experienced. So I think that, you know, we talk all the time in our field about the problem of the dying audience, of the small audience. We're trying to confront this at all levels. There are vast audiences out there who just really haven't felt invited or included. And that's not about social justice. That's about the survival of this art form. And that's about American society and people being better and feeling better and, you know, doing better together. It's a pretty big question.
Yeah. Talk to me about your personal background and how that connects you to these underrepresented voices.
I grew up in San Francisco. Dad grew up in Harlem. His family was from Jamaica, and he grew up in Harlem. My mom came from Akron, Ohio, Jewish lawyer. They met in San Francisco kind of towards the, I guess, you know, the end of like civil rights, 60s stuff. But, you know, what brought them together was this idealism, certainly. And so the three of us grew up with that. And I think there was a big underlying message in our home about like taking on the world, whatever that was going to mean. We all started music, three of us, so young. So there was just music in the house all the time. And we were very haphazardly homeschooled. My dad got sick when I was really little and he died when I was nine. So things were not easy at home. But I think, you know, that what that meant was that the music provided a center. It really, really did. And I don't know. I guess the other thing that was important was that one of my first teachers was a Holocaust survivor. And I somehow understood, you know, very young, this isn't just like a thing you do. This isn't just about practicing and learning the notes and doing well at your lesson. Like, music is important. I understood that music was important and it can serve a tremendous purpose in a person's life. It can maybe actually, you know, mean survival in your life. I think I was feeling that it was survival in my own life on some level.
So you grew up in San Francisco, homeschooled in a house with two sisters and three pianos. Was this like a not so subtle way your parents can ensure that none of you ever had an excuse not to practice the piano?
Oh, but we found our ways. We found our way. If one of the pianos was in the basement, which was super creepy, so there was this whole system of like taking turns and also bribing people to take your turn in the basement.
On the creepy piano.
On the creepy piano. It was a little nuts. But yeah, the music just, it was the through line. And then I think a lot of the work that I've done too goes back to my early memories of my dad, because he loved music and he listened to music a lot. He didn't play.
He was a biochemist, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, my love of the history of jazz comes from early days with him, for sure.
Hmm. Did you take to the piano immediately, or was it like the vast majority of the human species where it's difficult at first?
Loved the piano. Yeah. Loved it. And I have this one picture of myself at probably 6 or 7, and I had such good hands. I just love it.
So you were a natural.
I really was. Loved it. I'm a freakishly good sight reader. So it was just like this, that keyboard was just this entrance into this infinite world.
And as you grew, what was your relationship to practice? Was it ever a chore, or were you just entranced and self-motivated?
I'm not that weird. I mean,
yeah.
No, there were so many days when I wanted to go outside and later, you know, times when I just didn't feel like doing it. Isn't that interesting when you think back on all those hours that we spend? The question I always have for myself is, how many of those hours were just totally wasted anyway, right? Don't you ask yourself that sometime?
You're being humble about it, but, you know, a pianist just simply has to practice way more. I mean, maybe a violinist would get up there, but in terms of hours of practicing, you have to spend like a lifetime practicing scales and arpeggios in the hopes that eventually your fingers will kind of float unencumbered through the music. Do you remember the first time you felt that transcendence, that all the work that you had put in made the music easier?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Maybe I still feel like that. You know, maybe if you walk off stage and you're like, wow, I can do that.
But surprising when it does happen, right?
Yeah. So I asked myself how many of those hours were wasted. And at a certain level, even though hours when I had a book propped up on the music stand and I was reading it, but also playing at the same time so my mom wouldn't know. I mean, actually, maybe that's not wasted. That's kind of some amazing brain work, right? That's just like training your fingers to work on their own without your brain even being involved.
Well, those moments of transcendence, of something becoming more than the sum of its parts, can be fleeting and transient. When you perform, you have a job to do, and a lot of the music that you're playing is challenging. When you're performing, Are you able to kind of space out and lose yourself in the music as you're creating it? Or is that a luxury that you can't afford yourself?
No. The spacing out is so necessary. I think it's so necessary. And you know what I think is kind of the best, though, is when I'm playing with an orchestra. And it's not just me. And the spacing out, whatever it is, the floating, I think it's more like floating is happening, but it's, you're part of this collective whole. Do you know what I mean? When you play with others and like everyone is wordlessly communicating and feeding off each other. I mean, that's such a magic thing that we could take for granted if we wanted to. I really don't want to ever take that for granted because I think it's very magical. And I can't think of very many other, well, I guess if you're like playing basketball or something, that kind of communication is always happening. But it's on so many levels, right?
I always think it's awesome when musicians, well, I'll speak for myself. When I give sports analogies, I'm like, you know, it's like when you sink that shot or you hit that ball. I'm famously unathletic, but it's always, it always makes a really good metaphor, but yeah. I'm sure you're very sporty.
No, yeah. My God. No, that's why I just said, you know, when do you play the sports balls things? But you know, the other place where I'm just in awe and I'm sure, wait, do you play jazz?
I mean, alone, not in public.
Private.
Yeah.
But exactly. You know, when you're watching a jazz set and you're like, they don't even know the notes. Like they don't even, they're just making this up as they go. And then right. I feel like, you know, what I do is so trivial.
Yeah. Well, actually, I want to talk about jazz for a minute because there's almost nothing worse than a classical pianist being jazzy, or any musician for that matter, doing that jazzy thing. It's cringy, but it feels natural and sounds natural when you do it. What do you attribute this to?
Thank you, number one. Thank you so much. It means a lot. And I think that part of what you've been asking me about this music is like, how do you know how to play it? It's brand new. How do you know how to do it? And I think that I allow myself to be very instinctive with this music. And as I said a few minutes ago, you know, some of my earliest musical memories are sitting with my dad and listening to these jazz records. And it's not like I was analyzing them at the time, but they were just feeding into my ear and my self as the basis of my musical language. So I can't answer very well, you know, what it is that I do. I just think I let the music be what it wants to be. And I came right up against this last year. I put out this album of Scott Joplin's music. And there are different approaches you could take to that. You could try to be really authentic in a ragtime style, right? Put on like a boater hat. Or you could try to push that music really far into this realm of like, this is the greatest classical composer you never heard of. But I really, what I love is that American music sits in these places at the crossroads, which are sometimes even uncomfortable places. And you just have to let this stuff blend. So all I could do was just play Joplin the way I hear it, the way I feel it. And I know that it's coming from this very blended identity, experience, language, as it was for him, right? He's living in a very blended, blending time in America. So I think that's the answer. And I mean, I do feel comfortable in that language. I really, really do. And at some point, I'm going to take a year off, maybe in Hawaii, and just learn, you know, learn the theory and learn to read a chart and learn to improvise, not so that I can be a great jazz pianist, but so that I can have a different level of understanding of where that language comes from. I would like to do
right. Because of your mission and advocacy, you're constantly thinking about bringing music to audiences. And it seems like a one-way street, like you're working to find and perform for audiences. But I'm curious to know what you get out of the process as you're performing. What does it do for you?
I think I don't ever think of it as one directional. I think every time I'm in a room playing music, yes, for people, but I think I'm playing with people. And I feel very acutely the communication that's happening inside that room. And it's my way of being myself and I guess contributing what I can to the world. And, you know, there is this truth that anytime you're in that room making music, something changes. This 86-year-old woman who was at a concert of mine recently, Black woman, 86 years old, who had never heard the music of these Black composers that I was playing, who came to me, and she just had her birthday, and she was in tears, and she said, "This is the best birthday present you could have given me," and I realized her life changed at 86. You know, I just think there are moments of transformation, and you don't even know about them. And the challenge of this time is that problems are really big, right? These little moments in a room making music are actually huge and so, so powerful.
Mm. Lastly, I've been a lifetime subscriber to the New York Times, so I have to ask you what it feels like to be memorialized as a clue to 17 down in the New York Times crossword puzzle.
Unbelievable, right? I was in Maine and I was actually at a concert and somebody sent me a screenshot. And I thought, oh, that's cute. There's an app that you can make where you put
That's what I would have thought, too.
Right. And then I started getting all these things. And it was just like, it was so random. And it was so, it was kind of very thrilling.
That's a lifetime achievement.
Yes. It's all downhill from there.
Please tell me you have that in a poster framed somewhere on your wall or on your piano. You have to.
And I have t-shirts.
Okay. You one up me. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Speaking Soundly. If you like what you heard, please tell your friends about it. Spread the word. Be sure to follow, rate us, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up on future episodes, follow us on Instagram at SpeakingSNDLY and visit our website, artfulnarrativesmedia.com. Tune in next week as we hear another inspiring artist speaking soundly.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.